KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
There is no scientific evidence that thimerosal has caused a problem.
New members of the CDC's Vaccine Advisory Committee resurrect questions favored by the anti-vaccine movement.
Today is Thursday, June 26th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. AI is flooding social media with fake videos about the conflict between Israel and Iran.
You have to understand, what can it do, what can it not do? And if you don't know, you're just asking to be lied to.
Also, ranchers in Northern California struggle to protect their livestock from growing numbers of gray wolves.
And former First Lady Michelle Obama sits down with our Wildcard podcast and says she's learning to say no more often.
Let me define what I want to do apart from what I'm supposed to do, what the world expects of me.
Those stories and more after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. The Pentagon and the White House are praising U.S. airstrikes on Iranian nuclear facilities as a success. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth says the latest assessment shows the attacks caused massive damage. NPR's Quill Lawrence reports Hegseth also attacked the media for suggesting otherwise.
The Secretary of Defense repeatedly praised President Trump's leadership in deciding to attack Iran's nuclear sites last weekend. He attacked the press for reporting on leaked preliminary intelligence assessments that cast doubt on whether Iran's nuclear program has been destroyed. Hegseth cited other Trump administration sources, as well as the international community, to assert that the mission succeeded. He said he was not aware of any intelligence that Iran might have moved some of its stockpile of nuclear fuel. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dan Kane, gave a lengthy presentation, including videos of the bombs, and describing the years of planning and hours of nonstop flight by U.S. servicemen and women. But he said a full assessment of the strike was still pending. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
Iran's Supreme Leader, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, does not appear to be cowed by the U.S. strike against the country's nuclear facilities this past weekend. The Iranian leader is saying his country has delivered, quote, a slap to America's face by a strike on a U.S. base in Qatar and warning against any further attacks by the U.S. It is the first public comments from the Ayatollah since American forces hit three Iranian nuclear facilities. Iran's missile attack on Monday caused no casualties. Even as the Trump administration has been pushing Senate lawmakers to advance the administration's so-called Big Beautiful Bill, the Senate parliamentarianism was advising the one aspect of the plan, a proposed Medicaid provider tax overhaul provision, might not pass muster. More from NPR's Deidre Walsh.
The issue here is that the Republicans included changes to how states finance their Medicaid programs. Rural states especially rely on these taxes that states levy on Medicaid providers. They boost how much money the states get from the federal government. But the nonpartisan Senate parliamentarian who vets the bill says this provision doesn't comply with rules that allow Republicans to pass a bill with just a simple majority.
The issue will make it far more difficult for Republicans rushing to finish work on the bill before the 4th of July holiday. The administration hosted an event today featuring people the White House says would benefit from the administration's tax cutting and spending measure. The U.S. economy appears to have shrunk more than outlined in an initial assessment during the first 3 months of this year. That's based on a revised estimate from the Commerce Department. According to the latest measure, the gross domestic product, the total volume of goods and services produced within U.S. borders, contracted at a 0.5% annual rate. The initial estimate showed a 0.2% decline. Stocks ran right up to the edge of new record highs on Wall Street today. The Dow was up more than 400 points. The Nasdaq also closed higher. This is NPR. Heat waves like the kind that covered eastern states this week will become more common. That's according to power grid managers, who are warning they could seriously degrade energy infrastructure without proper planning. Moz Bouchal reports from member station KUT in Austin.
Days and nights of extreme heat drive up power demand and keep generators and transmission lines working overtime. And heat itself, especially when nights are hot, also takes a toll on those components. Mark Lobby, chief engineer at the North American Electric Reliability Corporation, says utilities need to plan now for increasing weather extremes.
You know, this comes down to, trying to figure out exactly 5 years, 10 years, what is my new design criteria going to be? What changes am I going to be seeing because of the weather changes,
While the current heat wave subsides in eastern states, the National Weather Service says above average heat is likely this summer across the country. For NPR News, I'm Mose Bouchel in Austin.
The Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences is inviting hundreds of new members to its organization, adding recent Oscar nominees and many more to one of the most exclusive clubs in Hollywood. New class of Oscar voters include Dave Bautista, Aubrey Plaza, Danielle Deadwyler, and Andre Scott, among others. They, along with filmmakers, professionals, and executives, bring the total membership at the Academy to more than 11,000, with more than 10,000 of those people listed as voting members. Crude oil futures prices edged modestly higher today as inventory levels in the U.S. fell slightly. Oil rose 32 cents a barrel to $65.24 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington. It's been a couple weeks now since Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. gutted the panel that guides U.S. vaccine policy. This week, the new members met at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. The influential panel promised sweeping changes to how vaccine policy is made in the U.S. and resurrected issues that have been advanced by groups that question vaccines. NPR health correspondent Ping Huang was in the room, and she is with us now from Atlanta. Hi there.
Hey, Ari.
How'd the meeting go?
It was honestly quite dramatic, Ari. I've been watching these meetings for years, and this one was such a departure from how they usually go.
How so? What happened?
Okay, so it started with a veneer of normalcy. There were presentations and discussions and votes, but the conversations themselves were very different. Let me bring you in on one this morning about the annual flu vaccine. So the CDC staff started by presenting data that showed that the flu season we just had was really bad. They saw the highest rate of people being hospitalized for flu in more than a decade, and 250 children died, which is the most they've ever seen since they first started tracking this 20 years ago. The response from new member Dr. Robert Malone was it wasn't such a big deal.
The 250 pediatric deaths, which is, let's acknowledge, is a modest number, fortunately.
Malone went on to ask if the CDC was looking into whether there was some kind of, quote, broad-based allergy that might have contributed to the severity of the flu season. But a CDC official quickly changed the subject, and then they started a serious discussion about thimerosal, which is a vaccine preservative that is rarely used these days. There was a theory that it might be linked to autism, but that's been disproved.
Okay, so thimerosal, why did that come up today?
Okay, so the new committee chair, Martin Kulldorff, said that the committee was reopening topics like this to increase public trust in vaccines. And typically the presentations at these meetings come from CDC experts, but Kulldorff said that this new committee is open to all types of expertise. So they got a presentation from Lynn Redwood, who's the former president of Children's Health Defense. That's the group that Kennedy founded and he chaired, and it's advocated against vaccines and spread misinformation about them. So the committee heard her presentation. They voted on the topic, and while they agreed that people should be getting annual flu vaccines, the majority of them voted to limit the recommendations to the versions of the vaccines that do not contain thimerosal. Dr. Cody Meissner, a pediatrics professor at Dartmouth, was the only one who objected.
There is no scientific evidence that thimerosal has caused a problem.
And in previous ACIP meetings, this lack of evidence would usually just put an end to the discussion, but this time it sparked speculation and new recommendations.
Why are these recommendations important? What impact do they have on Americans generally?
So traditionally, ACIP recommendations are what doctors rely on to make, recommend things to their patients. These recommendations serve as the basis for state and local regulations, determine what insurance will cover and what kids, especially those with low-income backgrounds, have access to. But this meeting confirmed a lot of the fears that people in public health have had since Kennedy became health secretary. He's weakened vaccine recommendations, notably removing universal recommendations for kids and pregnant women to get COVID vaccines. And this committee is just getting started.
What's still to come?
So the committee is going to be looking at the vaccine schedule for kids and adolescents with an eye towards lessening the number of shots they get. They'll also be looking at established vaccines that have been around for more than 7 years. And this represents a real shift in how the committee approaches vaccines. They've come with a lot of questions, even on issues that have long been settled. And the makeup of the committee has really shifted away from people with deep expertise in vaccines, which is part of why this meeting was so different.
That is NPR's Ping Huang in Atlanta. Thank you.
You're welcome.
It can be hard enough to figure out what's happening during an armed conflict. As NPR's Huo Jingnan and Lisa Hagen report, AI is adding more challenges. It's generating ever more realistic video, and AI chatbots are helping create and spread false information.
In the first days after the Israeli military's surprise airstrikes on Iran, this video started circulating on X. The narration is in Azeri, and the video is made to look like a newscast. It shows what looks like drone footage of a bombed-out airport, it says, is in Israel.
But it's not real. This video is AI-generated. On X, one post of the video got close to 7 million views. In the comments, users try to confirm whether the video was authentic by asking Grok, the integrated AI chatbot on X. Emerson Brooking is with the Digital Forensic Research Lab. It's part of the nonpartisan policy group, the Atlantic Council.
What we're seeing is an AI mediating the experience of warfare.
He says since its invention, mass media has been shaping public opinion about war, conflict, and politics. Today, hyper-realistic AI content and chatbots are adding new dimensions to these older dynamics. And Brookings says it makes sense that people are drawn to it.
There is a difference between experiencing conflict just on a social media platform and experiencing it with a conversational companion who's endlessly patient, who you can ask about the different sides of the conflict, what really happened, etc.
But just because you can ask a chatbot about a war doesn't mean you should trust its response.
I don't know why I have to tell people this, but you don't get reliable information on social media or an AI bot.
Hani Farid is a professor who specializes in media forensics at the University of California, Berkeley.
First of all, it's not what it was designed for. Chatbots aren't designed to analyze images for real versus fake.
As attacks between Israel and Iran picked up, users on X who asked Grok if photos and videos in their feeds were authentic got contradictory answers.
At NPR, we tried running similar queries on OpenAI and Google's chatbots, sending them images to fact check. While they got some things right, they still made mistakes. Another chatbot from the company Anthropic said it couldn't authenticate them one way or the other.
Chatbots can be helpful. Farid says they're part of his toolkit, but he's a forensics professional who always double checks what they spit out.
You have to understand what can it do, what can it not do. And if you don't know, you're just asking to be lied to.
Which can be one way to satisfy the appetite for information during a war or a fast-moving news event. It's the same urge that invites content creators to flood timelines with sensational media in these moments.
Now, tech companies don't share much data about how often people use AI chatbots to seek out news. Darren Linville is a Clemson University professor who studies how states like China, Iran, or Russia use digital tools for propaganda.
They're not doing anything that they weren't doing before. They're just doing it with fewer people and doing it at a higher volume.
Linville says decades ago, foreign influence campaigns could take years to bear fruit. Today, he says, generative AI can do this in days or even hours.
This technology helps with all kinds of things, coming up with false narratives, memes, or even filling out an entire fake news website. But the most effective way these messages actually reach a willing audience is still through prominent people or influencers that these state actors sometimes pay for.
They spread a lot of bread on the water, and some percentage of that picks up and becomes a prominent part of the conversation.
Whether it comes to propaganda or looking for information in uncertain moments, The researchers we spoke to said the most potent ideas are the ones that confirm what people already want to believe. Lisa Hagen.
And Huo Jinglan, NPR News.
Gray wolves disappeared from California nearly a century ago. In the 2010s, they started to come back. And now, their numbers have grown so much that ranchers in Northern California are complaining that their livestock is threatened. Four counties declared a state of emergency due to the wolves' presence this spring. From member station Cap Radio, environment reporter Manola Sakaida has this story about the emerging tensions over living with wolves.
Chad Smith's ranch, Barwon Cattle Company, is usually a peaceful place. It's located in a rural part of Northern California. But like many ranchers in the area, he's seeing wolves on his property. In a recent incident, his cow survived an attack.
Wolves 2 weeks ago got a hold of her, ripped her whole hind out.
He says even when a wolf doesn't kill a cow, it can have longer-term impacts on his income.
I don't think we'll be able to breed her now. I mean, we're losing 10 years of calves because of, you know, she was chewed up as a young heifer.
Right now, ranchers are only allowed to scare off wolves using tactics that don't injure them, like shining bright lights or making loud noises. Many in the region say that isn't working. According to the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, wolves killed 58 livestock last year. And while the state compensates ranchers for proven losses, they don't compensate for indirect impacts, like stress. Axel Honeycutt is the gray wolf coordinator for the state and says stress can lead to weight loss and fewer calves. That creates uncertainty for ranchers.
You know, you could imagine someone wondering, like, shoot, what is my future?
The Department of Fish and Wildlife is now able to consider more aggressive tactics as part of the conservation plan they launched for the endangered wolf in 2016.
So this is things like rubber bullets, bean bags, various kinds of sprays, like bear spray and whatnot on them, as well as potentially pursuing with vehicles to push them away from an area of conflict.
Amaruk Weiss is the Center for Biological Diversity's senior wolf advocate. She says she understands the need to move to more aggressive tactics, but only if ranchers have already tried the non-harmful ones.
I think what's most important is to, first of all, not have that be your first reaction.
Some change is on the way. In early June, the Department of Fish and Wildlife launched a pilot program to support ranchers. The agency is helping them create plans to protect their livestock with non-lethal methods. They're also providing a team on the ground that will be able to use more aggressive tools to handle wolves, although those options are still unavailable to ranchers. For NPR News, I'm Manola Sakaida in Sierra County.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland more vibrant, sustainable, and just, and setting an example for the nation. More information available at gundfoundation.org. From the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at WTGrantFDN.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Former First Lady Michelle Obama is saying no more often. This year, she skipped both the inauguration of President Trump and the funeral of former President Jimmy Carter. Those decisions drew some scrutiny in the press. Obama sat down with NPR's Rachel Martin recently, and the former First Lady said she is finally at a stage in life where she feels like all of her choices are her own.
One of the major decisions I made this year to stay put and not attend funerals and inaugurations and all the things that I'm supposed to attend, that was a part of me, you know, using my ambition to say, let me define what I want to do apart from what I'm supposed to do, what the world expects of me. And I have to own that. Those are my choices. Whatever the backlash was, I had to sit in it and own it. But I didn't regret it, you know.
Yeah, because it's your life.
It's my life now, and I can say that now. But we'll see. There may, maybe next year we sit down, I go, you know, Rachel, went a little too far.
I'm going to rein it back in.
One of the platforms that Michelle Obama is using to define who she is now is a new podcast with her brother. It's called IMO with Michelle Obama and Craig Robinson. They share stories of growing up together, talk to famous guests, and offer advice to listeners. She says the timing made sense after the death of her mother, Marian Robinson.
It's been a year, just a month ago, since my mother passed. And we were starting to have these conversations a little bit. But I think once my mom passed and the notion of doing something with my brother, you know, where we would be forced to see each other on a regular basis became a big motivator, right? To carry on just the tradition of family that you lose when you lose the last elder. It's also that time in life where Craig and I looked at each other and we're like, well, we're it. We are the elders in our family, right? And kind of realizing, well, let's step up because, you know, look, we were blessed with a lot of wisdom and a lot of unique perspectives from two parents who were no longer here. And a lot of people didn't have that. So we have an opportunity to keep their memory and that wisdom alive, and then to share it with others who may not have that same kind of support system.
Michelle Obama joined Rachel Martin on NPR's Wildcard podcast, where guests answer big questions about their life drawn from a deck of cards. And Obama opened up about knowing that the time she has left is limited.
You know, as we get older, you know, look, and my husband thinks this is morbid, but at 61, you know, if I am lucky, if I am truly blessed, I'm like 25 more summers.
Oh, yeah. I do that math all the time.
Yeah. You know?
And I measure out how old my kids are against that.
Yeah.
And,
yeah. Because if you're not mindful about time, you know, like, 10 years, we've been out of office for 10 years.
Right.
What happened? What happened to those 10 years? You know, I mean, it's like, what I did a lot, right? I mean, two, three books, there's a lot that happened, but it went by fast. And I'm at the stage of life where I want the next 10 years to go by slowly. Because guess what? I love life. I love my life. I love life. But if you are, what I feel is that if I'm not mindful about it, the years slip away and you wind up spending a year doing what? Did you do anything you wanted to? Did you spend time with the people that you wanted to spend time with, doing the things that you wanted to do? And there's a part time in life for all young people where you just don't have that luxury because you're grinding and growing and building. You haven't earned it yet, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And you should be mm-hmm. out there doing and shaking and baking. And but with 25 more summers, I want to know, I want to feel each one of them.
Mm-hmm. I know.
I want to be like, ooh, this year, ooh, this was slow. Mm. It's like, I ain't do much of anything. Did I accomplish anything?
You got,
I got bored and I was like, oh, I read another book. Oh, it took forever.
Do you think you're comfortable with real slowness though? Like, do you think that's
yes.
Oh, you are, okay.
Oh, yes, I am. And a day of nothing is one of those nice slow days where you look up and go, oh man, it's only noon.
Yeah.
I want more of those because I want these last 25 summers to feel long mm-hmm. and purposeful mm-hmm. and mine, mm-hmm. not because I've given that time away and I looked up and it's all gone. Mm-hmm. I've given it all away to everybody else mm-hmm. and I don't even know what was left for me.
Right.
And so I think all of that is a part of thinking about death.
Totally.
You know, and when it comes, I'm not afraid of it, but...
You're not?
No, I'm not, but let me tell you one thing that was interesting to me, and I think you're the first person I share this with publicly, is like the last year of my mom's life, she was sick. Her body was just shutting down for a number of various reasons. And her last bout of illness, she was with me in Hawaii, in our home in Hawaii, which was a blessing, yeah. right? Because she was forced to let me take care of her.
Mm-hmm. She didn't want
Oh my
she
God.
Want to be a burden.
She didn't right. want to be a burden. And ooh, did I had doctors and nurses and everybody coming in, and we had her diet and this, and I was bossing her around, and she was mad, and she was, I just want to go home. And it's like, but you can't, you're stuck with me. You know, I could just take care of her. Yeah. And she got better and went back to Chicago. But we were sitting on the couch watching one of her court shows, because she liked court shows. And she was realizing that, you know, she will not ever be the same old self that she was. Yeah. She was starting to realize mm-hmm. she's coming to the end. And this woman that prepared me for death, right, and talked to me about all this stuff and was like, I'm ready to die. Who needs to be old people around too long? Blah, 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 blah. She leaned over to me and she said, wow, this went fast. And I held her hand. I said, what are you talking about? And she said, life. Yeah. She said, this went fast. And this was the woman who was ready. And what that told me was that even when you tell yourself you're ready, if you're living a good life, you're never really ready for it to end, yeah. right? So I hope I feel that way, even though I will be ready for it, you know, because it's been good and purposeful that I'll feel like, I wish I had more time.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to live my life like that, you know?
You can watch that full conversation by following Wildcard with Rachel Martin on YouTube. And you can listen to Michelle Obama's new podcast, IMO with Michelle Obama and Craig Robinson, now.
Support for Wildcard with Rachel Martin comes from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org.
This is NPR News.
Narciso Barranco was arrested by Border Patrol officers. Several videos online show him fleeing masked federal agents who pinned him to the ground and repeatedly hit him.
He accepted the fact that it could happen, but what we weren't prepared for and didn't prep him about was these guys attacking him.
We speak with his son Alejandro tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Some 007 fans might have been worried when Amazon MGM took over the Spy franchise.
But when Denis Villeneuve was named the director, there was relief.
He can do spectacle, but he also does character and emotion.
That story after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Duane Brown. The Supreme Court has ruled states can cut off Medicaid funding for Planned Parenthood. The South Carolina case will force low-income patients there to seek care from a smaller group of providers who accept Medicaid. From South Carolina Public Radio, Mayan Schechter has more.
Medicaid benefits do not cover abortion procedures, but they do cover patient access to birth control, cancer screenings, and other testing. South Carolina House Democratic lawmaker Heather Bauer worries that the decision will make matters worse for a state with poor health outcomes for lower-income residents.
They're continuing to find ways to chip away at affordable and accessible health care, and they're going to continue to do that.
Bauer says the court's decision, along with proposed cuts to Medicaid, will compound the problem. For NPR News, I'm Mayan Schechter in Columbia, South Carolina.
Utah Republican Senator Mike Lee says he isn't backing down on his push to sell federal land. But NPR's Kirk Sigler reports the Senate parliamentarians stripped the plan from the current spending bill.
The proposal to sell federal public lands in the West has drawn bipartisan backlash. Senator Mike Lee is now floating a scaled-back plan that bars any U.S. Forest Service lands from sales and would only allow sales on federal land within 5 miles of a city. In a tweet, Lee said American families need affordable housing. Land Tawney with the lobbying group American Hunters and Anglers calls that a ruse.
My guess is that they're not going to develop that for affordable housing, maybe a small portion, but it's going to be going to, you know, to develop condos for rich people to be there once a year.
It's not yet clear if this latest public land sales proposal will make it back into the president's so-called big beautiful bill in time for a vote. Kirk Sigler, NPR News, Boise.
Well, stocks finished higher across the board on Wall Street after a pair of better than expected reports on the economy. You're listening to NPR News. Anna Wintour has announced after some 37 years she will move away from the editor-in-chief position at American Vogue. Wintour will continue in her roles at Condé Nast and for Vogue, as we hear from NPR's Elizabeth Blair.
Anna Wintour is believed to be the inspiration for the Boss from Hell character Miranda Priestly in the novel and movie The Devil Wears Prada. The novel was written by one of Wintour's former assistants. The shoes the next Vogue editor-in-chief will need to fill will certainly be elegant and expensive. According to Vogue, Wintour told staff today about a new job opening, head of editorial content for American Vogue. Wintour's plate has been full in recent years. In addition to the day-to-day editing of American Vogue, she oversees almost all of Condé Nast's other brands, including Wired, Vanity Fair, and GQ. Wintour joined Vogue as editor-in-chief in 1988. She went on to launch Teen Vogue and Men's Vogue. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
In Paris, Faith Kipyegon was just 6.5 seconds short of becoming the first woman to break the 4-minute mile today, the 3-time Olympic champion surpassing her own world record, but falling short with a time of 4 minutes and 6.42 seconds. The event was unofficial, so the time won't be recognized. Kipyegon set the women's mile record 2 years ago and remains a dominant figure in the middle distance running. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station And from BritBox, committed to shaking up people's watch list with British TV, including new original series like Ludwig, starring Peep Show's David Mitchell. Streaming now at BritBox.com/NPR. From Your Part-Time Controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. YPTC.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. It was 10 years ago today when a Supreme Court decision legalized same-sex marriage across the country. That decision, known as Obergefell versus Hodges, overturned state bans that were championed by religious conservatives. A decade later, where do faith groups stand now on same-sex marriage? Well, for more on that, I'm joined now in the studio by NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose. Hi, Jason.
Hello.
Okay, so just for context, where were or what were the numbers 10 years ago for and against same-sex marriage?
Well, also in 2014, Pew Research released a very large study that found among religiously affiliated U.S. adults, 46% favored same-sex marriage. The number was 44% among those who identified as Christian. And among other religions, there was support from about 4 in 10 Muslims as well, but very strong support among Jews, Hindus, and Buddhists.
Okay, and how have those numbers changed since Obergefell?
Well, it turns out we have really good data to compare because of another Pew Research study released earlier this year. Overall, support for same-sex marriage has increased significantly. More than two-thirds of all Americans support it. And that increase includes religiously affiliated people, whose support jumped 12 points to 58%. And among all Christians, it's now more than half, 55%, who support same-sex marriage, with Catholics and mainline Protestants most in favor.
Well, what about specifically groups that have historically been opposed to LGBTQ rights?
Well, support has even gone up with them, including those who attend historically Black churches, Catholics, Mormons, and evangelical Protestants. In fact, Elsa, it's striking to see that now more than a third of evangelicals support same-sex marriage. And you know, they were, and in many ways still are, the backbone of opposition.
Aren't some evangelical groups still working to overturn Obergefell?
That's right. Yeah. They're vocal and in many cases powerful. For instance, the Southern Baptist Convention, the largest Protestant group in the U.S. Just earlier this month at their annual meeting, they overwhelmingly passed a resolution calling for the overturning of same-sex marriage. Here's Brent Leatherwood, who heads the Southern Baptist Convention's Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission.
We're going to be out there talking to individuals, talking to lawmakers, talking to neighbors. We'll be in courthouses, we'll be before Congress, but we will also be speaking to culture.
And keep in mind, Elsa, powerful people in government are Southern Baptist, including House Speaker Mike Johnson.
Right. Okay, well, given that support for same-sex marriage seems to be going up, even among people of faith, why do you think religious opposition to it is still worth watching?
Well, in part because of what happened with abortion rights. Leatherwood says they're inspired to call for overturning Obergefell in part because of their success in ending Roe versus Wade.
As you saw with the overturn of Roe, that took 50 years. So we would have to be patient.
Some also see the Supreme Court's recent decision allowing states to ban gender-affirming care for trans minors as evidence they would have a shot with the Supreme Court. But there are significant obstacles, Elsa, to overturning Obergefell. First, a law Congress passed in 2022 called the Respect for Marriage Act that would make unwinding it really difficult. And also support for same-sex marriage, as we said, has been increasing quickly and even quickly among people of faith who once opposed it.
That is NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose. Thank you, Jason.
You're welcome.
Today, the Supreme Court delivered a backdoor body blow to Planned Parenthood, ruling that states may cut off Medicaid reimbursements for the organization's non-abortion medical services. NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports.
The federal Medicaid law says that patients must have their choice of doctor, or as the statute puts it, patients are entitled to choose, quote, any qualified and willing provider. But today the Supreme Court ruled that regardless of those words, patients and medical providers cannot sue to enforce that provision of the federal law. Writing for the court's conservative supermajority, Justice Neil Gorsuch said that particularly in cases that put conditions on how federal money is spent, Congress must clearly and unambiguously authorize the right to sue as an enforcement mechanism. And Congress, he said, did not do that here. Indeed, he noted, the statute nowhere uses the term right to sue. Writing for the three liberal dissenters, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson countered that the words in the statute, quote, could not have been clearer. Today's decision, she said, will strip Medicaid recipients all over the country of a deeply personal freedom, the ability to decide who treats us at our most vulnerable. Planned Parenthood President Alexis McGill Johnson, in an interview with NPR, said the decision would have widespread ramifications and would allow some 17 states to strip Planned Parenthood clinics of the ability to provide non-abortion services to rural and low-income people.
It is a dark time. Anytime a health center has to close, anytime a patient is not able to get the care that they need, that is a dark time because we can provide care for our nation's most vulnerable.
Jim Campbell of the conservative Americans Defending Freedom, however, sees today's decision as a necessary correction to allow states to determine how they allocate federal funds.
This is a really big deal for states that have been sucked into a lot of federal litigation. And if states decide to adopt pro-life policies, then they should be free to determine that Medicaid dollars are spent consistent with that.
University of California professor Mary Ziegler, author of 7 books on the history of abortion and abortion policy, notes that federal funds have long been banned for abortion, but she says that Planned Parenthood clinics serve as primary care providers in many underserved areas, including in South Carolina, where today's case began. In that sense, she says, today's court ruling is not about abortion, but it's likely to put a financial strain on many Planned Parenthood clinics, forcing some to close their doors.
So I think we're going to see kind of the expansion of existing healthcare deserts in a lot of those states.
And if Congress defunds Planned Parenthood entirely, as it well might in the coming weeks, she says there would be a ripple effect even in states where abortion is legal.
Even in places like Southern California, where Planned Parenthood does a pretty good job fundraising, I think some affiliates there receive 30% of their funding from Medicaid, so that would be a huge hit.
Today's Supreme Court case began in South Carolina when the governor issued an executive order banning Planned Parenthood South Atlantic from the roster of Medicaid providers approved by the state. The clinic and one of its patients challenged the executive order in court and won repeatedly over a period of years until today. Professor Ziegler sees what she calls a supreme irony in all of this.
For years, the pro-choice movement thought it would need to defend its victories in court. And I think the pro-life movement had this fantasy that if the courts were removed from the picture and Roe was gone, they would just go from victory to victory. And instead, we've seen the long-term trend since the end of Roe has been that pro-choice groups are winning victory after victory with voters. And it's pro-life groups that have seen that they really need the courts to win.
Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain Podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. And today's story comes from Eric Johnson. In January 2022, Eric Johnson's husband, Dennis Hopkins, was diagnosed with lung cancer. Their days of enjoying music, dancing, and gardening quickly turned into a life that was centered around cancer treatments. One day, Hopkins became too weak to sit up and was admitted to the hospital. The couple was told that he'd need another round of radiation, but even with the new treatment, he would only have a 50% chance of surviving. It was during this hospital stay that Eric remembers meeting their unsung hero, a nurse named Sherry.
She was something wonderful, like out of a movie. This sturdy woman in her blue scrubs with her pigtails. She turned to both of us and gave us the kindest, most no-nonsense roadmap for what actually did happen in the next 2 weeks. She looked at me and she said, "He's going to want to go before you're ready, but you just have to let him go." Then she looked at him and said, "When you're ready to go, it's going to be really hard on him. So you have to be really sensitive to him." Then she looked at both of us and said, "And everybody dies exactly the way they want to. If he goes when you're not in the room, it's because he couldn't bear to have you there. But if he goes when you are in the room, he wouldn't have it any other way." And you know, that's exactly what happened. The day that he left, I had to come and go from the room a number of times. Then one time when I came back in the room, I looked at him and I realized something different was happening. I hurried over to him. I put my hand on his chest and on the back of his head. I said, "I'm right here. I love you. I'll always love you. We'll always be together." And I just kept repeating that until he stopped breathing. If Sherry were standing in front of me today, first of all, I would hold her hands and look right into her eyes and say, "I can never thank you enough for what you made possible for Dennis and I to have his death go so perfectly. I wanted everybody in the world to hear what you taught us, because everybody in the world can learn a wonderful lesson from what you taught us that day. And thank you so very much."
Eric Johnson of Seattle, Washington. Eric and his husband, Dennis Hopkins, were together for nearly 30 years. You can find more stories of unsung heroes and learn how to submit your own at hiddenbrain.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from Linda Moot Bell Learning Centers, one-to-one instruction to help students catch up or get ahead, online or in-person instruction for reading, comprehension, and math. lindamootbell.com/NPR.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. 23andMe was once a high-flying biotech firm. It collected a trove of DNA data on millions of its customers. And then it went bust. The fate of that data has been at the center of a legal battle over DNA privacy. NPR's John Ruwitch explains.
Learning about where your family came from made 23andMe an alluring choice for more than 15 million people.
My name is Kyle, and I got a gift from my parents a couple years ago that got each of them a 23andMe.
The test kits he got confirmed that one side of his family were Ashkenazi Jews.
It was definitely, you know, affirming, and I would say we mostly forgot about it after that.
And that was the problem with 23andMe's business model. It was a one-and-done product. Once people learned their ancestry or genetic health risks, they didn't need to test again. Some of them, like Kyle, stopped thinking about 23andMe. Until, that is, 23andMe filed bankruptcy this March, raising questions of what would happen to all that data. A pharmaceutical company called Regeneron won an initial auction to buy the remnants of 23andMe. Kyle was nervous about the idea of his family's DNA changing hands, especially after reports of a lawsuit filed after the company was hacked in 2023. It alleged that 23andMe had failed to notify Chinese and Ashkenazi Jewish customers that their data had been targeted and was being sold online.
I think historically there's a concern amongst the Jewish community for people, you know, knowing who we are, where we live, and our genealogy. And if that information gets into the wrong hands, it's very dangerous.
Kyle asked NPR to only use his first name out of concern that being publicly identified could make him a target of anti-Semitism. Last year, 23andMe agreed to a settlement in the data breach suit without admitting wrongdoing. Kyle deleted the family's DNA data via the 23andMe website. It's an option the company says all customers have. But this spring, more than two dozen states filed a lawsuit to halt the sale.
The idea of auctioning off customers' DNA to the highest bidder is just not okay.
Justin Leonard represents Oregon in the state's lawsuit. It argues that genetic data is not ordinary property that can be sold off like other assets in a bankruptcy, say desks or real estate, nor is it covered by HIPAA, the law that protects your medical information. The states want to make sure that consumers have full control over this highly personal and unchangeable information.
You can get a new phone number or a new credit card if the information is stolen, but you can't change your DNA.
A consumer privacy ombudsman overseeing the bankruptcy sale said consumers should be allowed to give separate and affirmative consent before their DNA data is sold. In response, 23andMe reopened the auction, and the new winning bid quickly made news. Here's how CNBC put it.
All right, in the meantime, Ann Wojcicki, the former CEO of 23andMe, has won the bidding to take over the company.
Ann Wojcicki, a co-founder of the company, had set up a nonprofit called the TTAM Research Institute, TTAM being the acronym for 23andMe. It would honor 23andMe's privacy safeguards and keep the DNA data from moving. Lawyer Justin Leonard says this outcome satisfies the state's concerns.
It's going to be under the same privacy policies, the same cybersecurity protections, same management as it was before. We don't believe this is a transfer that state law intended to prohibit or intended to require consent for.
But he says they're keeping the lawsuit active in case the TTAM sale falls through. TTAM did not respond to emailed questions from NPR. Regeneron says it's declined to submit a new bid. Still, the case cast a spotlight on genetic privacy, said Laura Cordes, an expert in bankruptcy at Arizona State University's law school.
My hope is that the issues that this case raises and the attention that it's gotten will in turn spur some meaningful thought about data privacy protections and those protections in a bankruptcy.
And hopefully, she says, lawmakers will be moved to create more robust protections for genetic information. John Ruwitch, NPR News.
This week, we learned more details about the next James Bond movie. A celebrated director has signed on to lead the next installment of the famous spy franchise. NPR's Bill Chappell reports.
Film director Denis Villeneuve figured out how to make the complicated world of Dune appeal to the movie-going public. Now he's taking on a new mission, bringing the secret agent James Bond into the future without Daniel Craig in the lead role. Villeneuve, who is French-Canadian, says he grew up with the Bond movies. Back in 2021, he was asked about maybe directing the next Bond film. Here he is on the Happy, Sad, Confused podcast with host Josh Horowitz.
I would deeply love to one day make a James Bond movie. And it's a character that I've been with, like everybody, like since my childhood. And it's like I have like massive affection for Bond.
Now Villeneuve will try to share that love and reboot a film franchise that dates to the 1960s. British fans were alarmed earlier this year when an American company, Amazon's MGM Studios, took creative control of the James Bond movies. Now, many fans are happy Villeneuve will be in charge of the first film under the new deal.
Well, the nice thing about him, and he kind of proved it really dramatically in the Dune series, is he can do spectacle, but he also does character and emotion. I mean, those Dune movies would have died on the vine if you didn't really get behind his lead characters.
That's Stephen J. Rubin, author of the James Bond Movie Encyclopedia. He says he's worried that Amazon, which we'll note is among NPR's financial supporters, might dilute the Bond brand, something he thinks Disney has done with the Star Wars franchise. Villeneuve says that for him, Bond represents sacred territory, a tradition he wants to honor. That's good news to Graham Rye, editor and publisher of 007 magazine.
There's an untapped vein of gold there that really could pay dividends.
Rye would love to see the movies draw more directly from Ian Fleming's novels, especially how Bond's character develops over the series while trying to stay focused on his missions.
Bond's alone. He knows what he's been briefed to do. He goes out there and he does it to the best of his ability in any way that he needs to do. And that's something that is inherent in the character from the very first book.
One thing we don't know yet is who will play James Bond. Rye likes the actor Stuart Martin for the role. Like the late Sean Connery, he's Scottish. British betting houses are keeping a running tally of contenders. Here's Stephen Rubin.
I predict that the gentleman who's going to play James Bond will be, like Daniel Craig, relatively unknown. But I always joke that he's supposed to be playing a secret agent.
And a secret agent, Rubin says, should not already be a massive star. The James Bond International Fan Club welcomed news of Villeneuve's hiring with a simple message that said in part, "Welcome back, Mr. Bond. We've been expecting you." But Villeneuve's third Dune film isn't expected until late next year. So if you want to see the next Bond movie, you'll have to wait. Bill Chappell, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Workday. Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today, so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services, from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. From Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
When I play a guitar, I play from my heart and soul. Yeah, I play my own music. And I just keep it up because the blues is something that people can't get rid of. Yeah. And if you ever have the blues, remember what I tell you. You'll always hear it.